Good afternoon, it's 3 o'clock and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on Monday, the 9th of April, the year 2012. Jeff found you on a Juneau afternoon. Today we'll find out about the Juneau Cribbage Club with guests Ron Crenshaw and Tom Judson. Lisa Corcoran from the Southeast Regional Resource Center will be talking about their driver's training program. We'll also talk with the lovely drifters who perform tonight at the Alaska Folk Festival. At Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music and more today on a Juneau afternoon. Weather forecast for tonight, increase in clouds, low temperatures around 32 degrees. Forecast for Tuesday looks like mostly cloudy weather with high temperatures around 55 degrees. Wednesday, mostly cloudy weather with high temperatures again at 55 degrees.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. An Oklahoma tribe may not be waiting on permission to open a casino near Tulsa. As Kurt Gortney with KGOU reports, gambling could begin on the site by the end of the month.
Despite protests from thousands of residents, a pending state lawsuit, and a lack of approval from a national gaming organization, officials with the Kyalege tribal town are trucking in prefabricated buildings to temporarily house the Red Clay Casino. The tribe started work on the 20-acre site next to a busy turnpike in northeast Oklahoma late in 2011. Opponents of the project, including some state and federal lawmakers, say the casino site will reduce property values and is too close to schools and churches. But Kyalege leader Tiger Hobia said the casino is needed because the tribe lacks the resources to fund programs that serve its members. The tribe expects 120 people to work at the facility. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gortney in Oklahoma City.
A Navajo man pleads guilty in the killing of a Navajo police sergeant. Last week, 49-year-old Victor Bigman pleaded guilty to second-degree murder in federal court. He initially was charged with first-degree murder for the killing of Sergeant Daryl Curley. Court documents show Curley was attempting to take Bigman's son into custody last summer when Bigman shot and killed him on the Navajo reservation in Arizona. Bigman admitted he shot Curley four times. Curley and his partner were responding to a domestic violence call. Curley was a 26-year veteran on the Navajo police force. Bigman is scheduled to be sentenced in July. He faces life in prison and a $250,000 fine. South Dakota's Black Hills State University is set to begin American Indian Awareness Week. Events are offered to celebrate the area's Native culture. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports.
Black Hills State University, located in Spearfish, South Dakota in the northern Black Hills, has the largest percentage of Indian students in the state university system. 5% of the undergraduate enrollment is Native. This week, a student group expects 2,500 people from as far away as Montana and Nebraska to visit the campus for BHSU's American Indian Awareness Week. The largely student-developed celebration begins Tuesday morning with a discussion on respect for diversity and cultural humility, featuring Northern Cheyenne cultural consultant and presenter Philip Whiteman Jr. Other discussions will center on current legal issues concerning tribes, the role of the media in creating unity or division, and Lakota spirituality. The week also includes dancing, powwow competitions, and hand-drum and singing competitions. A Black Hills State spokesperson says events are especially popular among international students on campus who enjoy the chance to sample Native culture. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbold.
An Alaska Native Corporation is giving a special dividend to elders. The Bering Straits Native Corporation announced Friday it's acknowledging the importance of the region's elders. The board of directors voted to issue a one-time special dividend of $500 to all qualifying elders. Eligible shareholders are those 65 and older who were issued 100 shares of settlement common stock in the corporation. Board Chairman Henry Ivanoff says it's important to recognize the contributions of elders and show appreciation for their support during difficult financial times. The distribution will be paid next month. On this day in 2011, elderly women from four tribes began walking from Olympia, Washington to meet other walkers for the Mother Earth Water Walk. The first walk was held in 2003 around Lake Superior to raise awareness about water issues. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
Humboldt State University, part of the California State University System, offering a part-time, three-and-a-half-year online Master of Social Work program, emphasizing work in rural and indigenous communities. A new semester begins January of 2013. Applications will be accepted in August. Learn more at humboldt.edu/socialwork.
Support for National Native News comes from the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller, and Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Time is 3:05 and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. First guests are Ron Crenshaw and Tom Judson here to talk about the Juneau Cribbage Club. Ron and Tom, thank you for being in the station with us today.
Thank you.
So my first question is, it's been like 40 or 50 years since I played a game of cribbage. Could you go over the game itself and the basic rules?
Basic rules still remain the same. They haven't changed those.
It doesn't mean I remember them.
Oh, well, that's true. The idea is to be the first one to get 121 points and win the game.
How do you win the points?
By playing... taking 15 twos and scoring hands, and the highest hand you can possibly score is a 29 hand, which is extremely rare, although Ron had a 28 hand here about a month and a half ago.
So let's say you're talking to somebody who's absolutely never played cribbage before. How do you play it in the first place?
You want to take that, Ron?
Sure. Normally it's played between two individuals, but you can play three or four, and you have a standard deck of playing cards, like poker cards. Don't play with the jokers. You deal six cards. If you and I were playing, Jeff, you'd get six cards. I'd get six cards. And if I were the first dealer, which you determine by cutting the deck and the low card deals, then I would get a second hand to count, called the kitty. And you'd put two cards into that kitty, and I'd put two cards in, which leaves us each a four-card hand and then a four-card kitty for the dealer to count. So the first person to play, the dealer gets to count two hands the first time, and then it alternates back and forth. And then you start by person leading one card.
And don't forget to cut.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Got to turn over the fifth card.
Yeah, that's right. There is a fifth card in the pack, and you cut the pack and turn up a card, and then that card counts in all three of the hands.
Well, you managed to totally confuse me.
Well, you know, the game is several hundred years old. It's been around a long time. It's not a modern game, but it does appeal to kids because there's a lot of math skills involved. You count combinations of of cards that equal 15. So if you started the game and you played a 5, for example, and I played a king, king counts 10, five counts 5, so that's 15 points. So if I scored after I played my king and made 15, I'd get 2 points on the board. And between us, there's a scoreboard that has 121 holes in it and pegs, and you add up, you keep your own score. Of course, your opponent watches to make sure you're keeping it correctly.
How many pegs do you get?
Two pegs,
and you just jump over one, your own peg, as you add points.
Do you use a fancy cribbage board made out of ivory and scrimshaw?
We use a very plain board so that there's no confusion. It's a white board with, you know, so it's good contrast and nothing fancy to distract the players.
And you play by national rules?
Correct.
Yeah, the Juneau Club is affiliated with the American Cribbage Congress, which is a national, I guess, international.
It's been around since 1980.
How long does it take to play a game?
Maybe 15, 20 minutes.
And on any given Monday, we play every Monday, including tonight at 6 o'clock at the Juneau Senior Center down on 12th and Egan. And if people want to play tonight, they're welcome. You don't have to be a club member to come and either observe or play. And it's a coincidence that we play in the senior center. We're not, as you can tell, we're not old enough to be seniors.
You look like teenagers to me.
Yeah,
pretty much.
Both
yeah.
are teenagers, yeah.
And so, you know, the purpose of being here is just to let people know that we exist. We play every Monday throughout the year at 6 o'clock, summer and winter. And after you play a game or two, and in order to keep playing, you need to join the club. And it costs $5 to join the Anchorage, the Juno. I came from Anchorage, the Juno Club. And $15 to join the American Cribbage Congress, which is the national organization.
But if you join the national organization, you are able to play any place in North America that has cribbage clubs. And there's 180 of those, almost 190 of those. And there's about 6,700 members in North America. So it's a lot of games going on every week all over the country.
What's the magic of the game of cribbage for you personally?
I think the competition, and I, for me personally, I normally played, I'm pretty new to the club. I normally played with my brothers or my wife or one-on-one, but back August last year, my older brother, who Alan Judson, who plays here, invited me to come in, and I tried it. And the big difference here is you play nine games, but you play them with different people every game. So it's a lot. It's quite a bit more exciting, I think, than just playing the same person all the time. So.
But it's pretty much one-on-one?
One-on-one, yeah.
One-on-one, and you rotate around the table, as Tom said, play a different person until you finish nine games. And then the person who has won the most games and has the most points wins. And you pay, if you're a club member, you pay $10, and that money goes into a pot and is redistributed at the end of the evening to the person who takes first, second, and third. And then if you get a 24 hand, which is pretty high, you get part of that pot too. So if there are six players, four people take away some of the money that they put in.
You mentioned having math skills helps a little bit. What else helps?
Luck.
Yeah, luck is important. I mean, we had a player last week who had phenomenal luck. He won eight of the nine games and skunked three people, which is means he won by more than 30 points. And so I think there'll be some people gunning for him tonight, probably.
I think the most exciting part of cribbage is when you've played an even game and through luck and skill, you come down to the last three or four holes or the last three or four points of the game, and it's really close, and you're both dealt hands, and the pegging, which occurs as you play a card, then I follow with a card, then you follow with a card, the maximum you can get is 31 points, and then you start over playing another card until you get as close to 31 as you can. If you get 31 exactly, you get two pegs for that, 2 points.
Is speed a factor here? Do you have to be quick and
no.
Not at all.
No, it's...
Games are different paced depending on who the players are.
Depending on the skill level. Some people, it takes longer to count the cards in their hand. For example, if you have a run of three cards in your hand, that's pretty easy to count. That counts 3 points. But if you have a double run of three, it counts 8 points. And some people have to count three, and then three again, and then a pair, and that equals eight. Some people can look at the cards and see it. That's eight.
And then sometimes when you're, because you're giving two cards to the player's crib or his kitty, you don't want to give him extra points. So it's sometimes a lot of players take a little time trying to figure out which two cards to take out of their hand and put in that kitty. So those two things, you know, have a tendency once in a while to slow the hand down, but
so there's a tactical side to it.
There's a tactical side to it as well, yes.
And the skill, the real skill of the game, I think, comes shows anyway right at the end of the game when you try to be as clever as you can in decoying your opponent into playing a card that you can pair, for example, and get 2 points.
Because if you pair a card, you get two. If you get a run of like a four, five, six, or six, seven, eight, or something, you get 3 points for the run, and then that other person might play a six and get 4 points. So you have to be careful of how you play those.
And you watch your opponent play cards, and after they've played a couple cards, you have a pretty good idea what the remaining cards in their hand are. So you try to play to avoid them pairing you or getting a run with your cards.
See, I didn't know you were doing that to me.
Yeah.
Is this something like you play in Vegas?
Well, I don't know if they
play. I don't know if they play cribbage in Vegas, but they do have a big tournament in Reno or Vegas.
Reno.
It has like a $10,000 prize on it. So.
Have you been to those games?
No. I'm not quite good enough yet to.
Nor am I.
Yeah.
What's the biggest game you've played?
You did play in a tournament here.
I won a Juno tournament about 3 years ago. I think there were about 40 people came to that tournament. And there hasn't been one since.
Well, we're going to try to get one this year going.
This fall we're going to have a citywide tournament. It's more than citywide. We invite people all over Southeast to the tournament. And it's an all-day tournament. Some days there are two-day tournaments. One of the things we wanted to, why we're here, Jeff, is not only to get people to come join us to play tonight at 6, but also if they're listening in Hoonah or some other location, or Gustavus even, is to start a local club. And we would be real happy to be catalysts for people to ask questions on how to start their own club. And when people are traveling through Juneau, like at Folk Festival, they're perfectly welcome to come join us and join in the game. There's no limit to the number of people who can play.
I'm going to talk with Ron Crenshaw and Tom Judson of the Juneau Cribbage Club. There's a game tonight at 6 o'clock, as there is every Monday. It costs a little bit to get in, but it's free otherwise. And phone number for contact if people want to get in touch with you?
Ron Crenshaw, phone number is 586-1796.
And Tom Judson is 209-1102.
All right, anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
Well, we've got a couple of signs up, pretty red and white signs in front of the Juneau Senior Center. So if you see those signs, that's where we play. And we'd love to see new players. The doors open at 5:30, and the games start at 6.
All right, Tom and Ron, thank you so much for coming down to the station and talking about the Juneau Cribbage Club.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks.
On a warm summer's evening, on a train bound for nowhere, I met up with a gambler. We were both too tired to sleep, so we took turns staring out the window at the darkness. The boredom overtook us, and he began to speak. He said, "Son, I've made my life out of reading people's faces and knowing what the cards were by the way they held their eyes. So if you don't mind saying, I can see you're out of aces. For a taste of your whiskey, I'll give you some advice." So I handed him my bottle, and he drank down my last swallow. Then he bummed a cigarette and asked me for a light. And the night got deathly quiet, and his face lost all expression. Said, "If you're gonna play the game, boy, you gotta learn to play it right. You got to know when to hold 'em, know when to fold 'em, know when to walk away, know when to run. You never count your money when you're sitting at the table. There'll be time enough for count when the dealing's done." Now every gambler knows the secret to surviving is knowing what to throw away, knowing what to keep. 'Cause every hand's a winner and every hand's a loser, and the best you can hope for is to die in your sleep. So when he'd finished speaking, he turned back toward the window, crushed out his cigarette, and faded off to sleep. Then somewhere in the darkness, the gambler, he broke even. But in his final words, I found an ace that I could keep. You got to know when to hold up, know when to fold up, know when to walk away, know when to run. You never count your money. When you're sitting at the table, there'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done. You got to know when to hold up, know when to fold up, know when to walk away, know when to run. You never count your money. When you're sitting at the table, there'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done. You got to know when to hold up, know when to fold up, know when to walk away, know when to run. You never count your money. When you're sitting at the table, there'll be time enough for counting when the deal's done.
Time is 3:21, and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Next guest, we're here to talk about AK Drive, the driver's training program offered by the Southeast Regional Research Center. Lisa Corcoran and Fred Weiler, thank you for coming down to the station today.
Thank you.
Thanks
for
having us, Jeff.
So this is a driver's training program. Could you go over it, if you could, please?
Yes, we can. Well, Southeast Regional Resource Center is an educational center that is located downtown on Ferry and Shattuck Way. And AK Drive started about a year ago. We started with rural communities in Southeast Alaska. Now we're offering it to Juneau residents. It was come together through many people collaborating, knowing that it was a need for Southeast Alaska to have a driver's training program. And so we started with funding, and we were able to serve about 124 students last year throughout the different rural cities in Southeast. And now we are starting with the Juneau program, and we have Fred Weiler and myself, our certified training instructors, and we're going to start next Friday, with our first
13th.
Session.
And we're not superstitious. We thought it'd be a great time to get behind the wheel with some fresh kids.
That job seems like a job that a lot of people would just relish, and just scare the Jesus out of me.
You know, I've had a lot of people who have asked me what's wrong with me, even before I guess I decided to do this, Jeff. But it's really kind of neat. We have a safety break. We have a vehicle that is designed specifically for instructing students in. And I don't know, we're in control of the situation, and we're just there to kind of observe and help the kids out. I'm not shaking too much yet. We'll see what happens when we get this first class going.
Who is it for?
We can work with basically anybody that's starting to want to learn to drive, get their permit, kids or participants that are basically the age of probably about 15 and a half. Can start. We can work with any age, actually. So if we have somebody that were to come into Juneau that was, you know, older, we would be happy to help them. In fact, we have a couple participants in this next session that are older that would like to learn how to drive. So we're pretty excited about that.
Cool. Yeah. What's included in the class? What do you teach them?
Go ahead. You can.
Well, some of the stuff that we teach, we focus on safety and proper driving techniques. We want to instill good habits into people when they're starting out to drive. And, you know, we were all taught how to drive differently by different people. And we're not going to, you know, say, hey, mom's doing it wrong or dad's doing it wrong, because everybody has something that they're bringing. And we just want to show the techniques and get people so that they're learning to look far ahead. A lot of times people, when they first start driving, they're looking down at the nose of the vehicle. So we want to get people to look as far as they can. Learn those good techniques, looking over your shoulder before you make a turn, checking that rearview mirror frequently, and just getting all those things that we just take for granted. When I first started, you know, I've been driving for about 30 years now, and when I first hopped in the class to become an instructor, it made me rethink how I drive. And you can ask my wife, after the first night of the class, we were driving to Costco, and I was practicing on her. Not smart. I don't recommend that.
What's included as far as the number of classroom hours versus the behind-the-wheel hours?
Well, classroom hours, we're going to have 12 classroom hours that will be provided in each session, and then we'll have up to a minimum of 8 hours behind-the-wheel drive time. We also have two driving simulators for more inexperienced drivers. They can have practice on the simulator. The simulator gives all different kinds of scenarios with driving. They will actually be able to feel what it's like to be on a 4- or 5-lane freeway with oncoming traffic. With large merge lanes coming in and out, something probably like California or Portland or something like that. They can have that kind of a feel. They'll have, you know, it depends on how much drive time they need, but they'll have a minimum of 8 hours in the car with us. When they're done, they will receive a completion certificate, and in that actually will help them with an insurance discount if they're under the age of 21, which is nice because my background, I am an insurance agent, but I've gone to work with CERC over the last 4 years, and so I know that that's a big need for parents, especially with young boys. I was going to share that under the age of 18, about 19,000 kids are killed in car wrecks in the year, and so our whole goal is to make sure that kids understand great driving techniques, they have proper seeing skills, communication skills with other cars. We want to make sure that we can save some lives. And so that's probably one of our biggest goals, along with the distractions that happen in a car. And Fred can probably talk about just the different distractions, whether it be...
Well, when you come to class, you'll be required to turn your cell phone off.
That's a good idea.
Yeah. It's a great idea. You know, I think we've all been guilty of that, of answering the phone, and I have during the course that we took with this instructor, he's been teaching for 35 years, and this gentleman had more information than we could ever go over, but that was one of the things that he had said. He said, I do not allow myself permission to answer my phone when I'm in the car. So he doesn't even have a cell phone, but I kind of thought, you know, that's a really good thing, and so this has been good for me. It's made me rethink some things that I do, because it's really easy to, oh, it's the wife, you know, do I need to stop and get milk on the way home? You know, if you do and it's that important, pull your car over to the side of the road. So I think the distractions and the safety thing, like Lisa said, are things that we're going to really hammer on. It's just too easy to have something happen. Everybody has a story about somebody that was distracted and knows somebody that was either killed or injured in a car accident because of it, and we don't want to see that here.
Other than distractions, what are some of the common mistakes people make?
I think that a lot of people don't scan far enough down the road to understand what their actual risk is. When Fred and I went through training, our instructor asked us to look as far down that we could, and I think I was the one that started kind of looking out, panning over just cars, but Fred was like, no, I see the mountain way out in the distance, and that's what people should be looking for, things that are risks that could come on, whether it be 5 feet away from you or 100 feet away from you. I think another thing is tailgating. I think people tend to drive way too close to the car in front of them. Typically, you want 3 to 5 seconds behind, you know, the car in front of you. You can figure that out by seeing a stationary object and counting 1-1,000, 2-1,000 to kind of get a general idea of how far behind you are. I think that communication, I think you need to be very aware of the cars around you. Blinkers, signals, all of those things, brake lights, those are other cars talking to you. And as a somebody, whether it be your experienced driver or a brand new driver, those are things you need to be watching for so that you understand what other cars are going to do on the road. And we also, just so everybody knows, is that a lot of cars tend to turn on their turning signal, and even though you think they might be turning left or right, you need to stay stationary and really make sure that that's where they're going before you head out into traffic.
Speaking as an insurance agent, about how does Juneau stack up against other communities of its size, or maybe even like places like Los Angeles?
As far as accidents, or I don't think, you know, that's kind of hard statistically to probably know where we are as a local community. I mean, we definitely have them. I think that most accidents are, well, they're accidents because, you know, people aren't paying attention, or
most of them are preventable.
Right. And, you know, whether it be everybody needs to be aware of the conditions of the road, the weather, all things. And right down to your car and the safety of your car, people need to go out and look at their car, check their windshield, check their wipers, check their brakes, walk around, make sure the lights are all working, just so that things like that aren't going to cause a wreck to somebody in front of you or behind you just because your car isn't working. So as far as statistics, though, as far as how many accidents Juneau has compared to other Southeast cities, I probably couldn't tell you, or somewhere south, I'm not sure.
Talking with Lisa Corcoran and Fred Weiler from the Southeast Regional Resource Center about AK Drive, the driver's training program they're offering. I imagine all this comes with a price tag.
It does.
Well, you I just know, guessed that.
Yes, it does.
We were very excited when we found out what we were going to be able to offer the course for. And it is only $535. And like Lisa said, that includes your instructional time of 12 hours and then a minimum of 8 hours behind the wheel.
And what ages is it for? Everybody at all ages, but are you targeted towards young people?
You know, we're targeting the folks that are just starting to drive. And there are people, we have a gentleman who's going to be on our class who is in his 20s, who hasn't driven before. And perfect opportunity for him as well. Anybody, you know, we've had inquiries from people in their 50s and 60s that haven't driven before and would like to learn how to drive. Sometimes there are people coming from other countries and just, you know, aren't familiar with the roads and the laws and how to drive here in America.
Right. The nice thing is the entire United States has the same road system. We have the same rules, regulations, and laws. And so if you learn in Juneau and you move to L.A., the signs, the speed limits, everything is going to be the same, you know. And so that's one great thing that the common part of it. So, you know, coming out of a little town like Juneau, but we actually had kids come last year from Cake, Wrangell, lots of smaller communities, even Gus Davis, who really doesn't have much, well, a lot of them don't have much of a road system, but they were able to get that practice time behind the wheel, and a lot of them got licensed, which was pretty exciting. And a lot of these kids were seniors in high school, ready to head out to college, and so, you know, it really opened a lot of opportunities for them.
And when is your next class scheduled?
This next Friday, we have our first class.
Yep, Friday the 13th, it's going to be at 4 o'clock till 8:30. We're going to have a little break time in between there since it is during the dinner hour. I need to eat too, Jeff.
We all do.
And then after that, there will be an actual driving schedule, and the participants will sign up to drive, and they'll have two-hour increments of drive time in the driver's training car. And then participants that have absolutely no experience can actually sign up to drive and use the simulators, and they can have as much time on the simulator. The simulator has 600 different driving scenarios, so there's a lot to learn there, a lot of practice time.
And people can also tag along when somebody else is driving and have what we call observation time, and they can just, it's not behind the wheel, but you're ingraining, and they're hearing all the same things over and over, so...
Mm-hmm. All right, if people need more information, I'd like to sign up. Is there a phone number?
There is. CERC's phone number is 586-6806, and Alaska Drive actually has an 800 number. It's 888-776-3321, and they also can go to our website at akdrive.org.
All right, Lisa Corcoran and Fred Weiler, thank you for coming by. Is there anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
Well, send your kids to us. We're trained to deal with the stress, and we're looking forward to helping out as many people as we can.
Right. We want to make it fun, and their job is to get rid of us, and so we're pretty excited about it.
Right, thanks for coming by.
Thank you, Jeff.
Yes, I'm gonna be a star. Baby, you can drive my car. here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 9th of April, 2012. It was on this day, 1865, General Robert E. Lee surrendered to General Ulysses S. Grant, effectively ending the Civil War. Lee's and Grant's armies had converged in Appomattox, Virginia. Fighting began at dawn. Within a few hours, Lee realized that his troops were outnumbered and surrounded, and his choice was to carry on a guerrilla war or surrender with dignity. He said to his staff, "There is nothing left for me to do but to go and see General Grant, and I would rather die a thousand deaths." But he dressed up in a crisp new uniform, his red silk sash, gloves, a ceremonial sword. He thought he might be taken as a prisoner of war as he rode his horse, traveler, to the front lines under a flag of truce in full view of the Union Army. Asked for a meeting with Grant that he wanted to discuss the question of surrender. So there was a ceasefire, and when Grant got the news, he sent word to Lee that he, Lee, should choose the time and place for a meeting. They found an abandoned brick house in town. Lee came in alone. General Grant came with a dozen of his generals and officers. They reminisced about the Mexican-American War, and then Grant brought up the subject of surrender. After the terms had been written and signed, Robert E. Lee rode back to his camp, and his soldiers were lined up alongside the road. They were cheering for him. He began to cry, and men reached out and patted his horse as he rode past. Here's a poem for today by Wesley McNair, entitled Old Guys. Driving beyond a turn in the mist of a certain morning, you'll find them beside a men-at-work sign, standing around with their caps on like penguins, all bellies and bills. They'll be watching what the yellow truck is doing and how. Old guys know trucks, having spent days on their backs under them, or cars. You've seen the gray face of the garage mechanic lying on his pallet, old before his time, and the gray as he turns his wrench, looking up through the smoke of his cigarette around the pupil of his eye. This comes from concentrating on things the rest of us refuse to be bothered with, like the thickening line of dirt in front of the janitor's pushbroom as he goes down the hall, or the same 10 eyelets Inspector Number 4 checks on the shoe, or the box after box the newspaper man brings to a stop in the morning dark outside the window of his car. Becoming expert in such details is what has made the retired old guy behind the shopping cart at the discount store appear so lost. Beside him, his large wife, who's come through poverty and starvation of feeling hungry for promises of more for less, knows just where she is and where, and who she is sitting by his side a year or so later in the hospital as he lies stunned by the failure of his heart or lung. Your father is what she calls him, wearing her permanent expression of sadness, and the daughter, obese and starved herself, calls him Daddy, a child's word, crying for a tenderness the two of them never knew. Nearby, her husband, who resembles his father-in-law, in spite of his Elvis sideburns, doesn't say, even to himself, what's going on inside him, only grunts and stares as if the conversation they were having concerned a missing bolt or some extra job the higher-ups just gave him, because this is what you do when you're bound after an interminable short life to be an old guy. Old Guy is a poem by Wesley McNair from Lovers of the Lost, New and Selected Poems, published by David R. Godin and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, produced by Kathy Roach and written by Heather McPherson. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Time is 3:41, and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our next guests are Amy Andrews and Alexia. Before me tonight is the Lovely Drifters. Here's a sample of their music right now. Listening to the music of the Lovely Drifters, Amy Andrews, and also Alexia from Atlanta, Georgia, and also Baltimore, Maryland, and Vancouver, B.C. They're performing tonight at the 38th Annual Alaska Folk Festival about 9:30 in the evening. Amy and Alex, thank you very much for being in the station with me today.
Thank you so much, Jeff, for
thank
having
you.
Us.
So it says in the program, Folk Blues Original Songs. You want to describe your music just a little bit better, please?
Yeah, absolutely. We're both classically trained musicians, but I grew up listening to a lot of folk and blues and standards, and I think that really informs the kind of music that I write and that we in turn play together.
And you met in the summer of 2009. What attracted you to each other's music?
Well, I've always listened to a lot of folk music, and I sort of was, this is horrible to say, but maybe a little burnt out of playing classical music so much because you don't really get to interact with the audience and in at all the same way that you do as a folk musician. And I was really drawn to the way folk musicians really sort of interact with the people for whom they're playing. It just seemed really fun and familial. And I was playing with another musician when Alex heard us play together, and we invited her to play with us. And several years have gone by, and now she and I have our own project.
Do you write your own tunes also, Alex?
Well, Amy has been writing these songs, and I've been writing the cello parts to go with them. And that's something that I've really, because I grew up playing classical music as well, this is something that's very different to me from what I grew up on.
What drew you to the cello?
The cello? Well, I started playing when I was 5 years old. It was something that my mother wanted me to do, or started me on, I guess, and it's something that I've then had as part of my life since then.
Amy also grew up on Broadway tunes.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And a lot of Sinatra.
All right. Tell me about your blog.
Our blog. We just created this project that's just the two of us just at the very end of 2011. And we decided that we were going to blog every day for 2012 and just blog about what it's like to be a brand new band project. And so the past few days have been taken up by a lot of travels in the Pacific Northwest and Alaska, and I'm really, really excited about it. It's exciting to blog every day to have that narrative.
Mm-hmm. Alexi originally from Vancouver, BC, moved to Baltimore and met Amy there, and then I was located in Atlanta, Georgia. What brought you to Atlanta, Georgia?
Well, when I was playing with Amy in Baltimore, we made several trips down the East Coast and stopped in Atlanta, and we found that there was a lot going on in music there that we could that we wanted to be a part of. So I guess that's the reason why we moved down.
Performing tonight at the 30th Annual Alaska Folk Festival at 9:30. Where'd you pick Alaska to come to?
Well, I'm not even sure where I saw the Alaska Folk Festival advertised, but I went on the site and I was really excited about it, and I really like that it's free and available to everyone. That's something that I don't think a lot of festivals can boast, and I think that it's just wonderful that the Alaska Folk Festival wants to celebrate musicians and musicianship from all around the world and to offer that to everyone free of charge. So I'm really, really happy that you all have us here.
Tell me about your inspirations in music.
I certainly take a lot from nature and the water, and so a lot of my lyrics involve water, rain, or ocean, or waves, or currents. So I will absolutely be writing something about the water while I'm here.
Got a lot of it, especially when it comes down from the top of the sky.
I bet.
Tell me about the song we heard just a few minutes ago.
That is actually called The Mariner's Song, and it was inspired by a difficult time that one of my friends was having in a relationship, and sort of very seafarer-inspired as well.
How long does it take you to write a song?
Oh, gosh, that depends. I have a song I'm still working on that I was working on in Baltimore about 3 years ago, but sometimes it will come to me in its entirety in an afternoon, and for that I'm very grateful.
Do you use tools like a rhyming dictionary?
No, I don't use a rhyming dictionary, but just the other day I thought to myself that I wanted to get more specific with my lyrics and that I might need to pull out a dictionary and just go through it and circle a bunch of unusual words that I don't use in everyday conversations and include them.
Alex, your inspirations in music?
In music? Well,
I guess. Or life?
In life in general. Well, as Amy was saying, for her, the outside and the nature and wilderness, growing up in BC, that was always something that was a part of my life and what surrounded me. So being here and being on the West Coast again is really great.
All right, well, it's fun to have the people that are coming from all over the United States to come play at the Alaska Folk Festival. The Lovely Drifters, where did the name come from?
I think drifting came absolutely because we travel a lot for music, whether it's near or far. We absolutely travel. We love to travel. I feel like I get really energized when I travel and get to see new places and meet new people. And then Lovely just because our music has been described as beautifully melancholy. So I think that that's a nice way to describe us.
Did you bring some CDs up here for sale?
Oh, for free. We're just going to give them away.
That's a deal?
Yeah. I hope it's a deal.
Performing tonight at about 9:30. Tell me about tonight's 15 minutes of fame.
It's going to be a rip-roaring, fun, beautifully melancholy time. I hope that people enjoy themselves.
All original music?
Absolutely.
All right, we're going to go out with a tune. Kind of number one on the CD. You want to describe it for me, please?
It's called North Georgia, and it's inspired by a drought that we had last fall in the southeastern United States.
All right, the Lovely Drifters, Amy Andrews, and also Alexia, thank you for coming down the station today and talking about your music and sharing it with us today and have fun tonight during the 30th Annual Alaska Folk Festival.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Packing my bags and pulling my roots and moving far away.
if you ask me to. But her mild winters and her shameless summers are not enough, Lord, to see this through. These sleepy sweet gums, heartbroken and heavy, have seen more of me than you have. And more I'm feeling heavy myself, more and more.
This is Bird Note. You just heard the grunt of a cormorant, the whistle of a cardinal, and the song of a song sparrow. Nearly all birds produce sound through an organ unique to birds, the syrinx. The syrinx is a set of muscles and membranes located where the two branches of the bronchial tubes converge to become the trachea. An adjacent air sac helps build pressure in the syrinx. In many songbirds, this whole song-producing apparatus is not much bigger than a raindrop. The syrinx is extremely efficient at creating sound, using nearly all of the air that passes through it. By contrast, we humans create sound using only 2% of the air we exhale through our larynx. Let's listen again to the limited vocal range of the cormorant, whose syrinx is controlled by only one set of muscles. The cardinal, a familiar bird of central and eastern states, creates its pure whistle by producing sound in its left and right bronchial tubes simultaneously. The song sparrow, like many other songbirds, has 5 to 7 pairs of muscles that govern the syrinx. It puts forth a cascade of trills and notes as if singing a duet with itself. You can hear any episode of Bird Note again, even sign up for the podcast, when you come to our website, birdnote.org.
3:58, and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau. We broadcast 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. Also broadcast on these translators. In Thalanoch Bay, tuned to K276 AF at 103.1. Kilamina Switzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM 88.1. K220BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. Excursion Inlet at Icy Street, you can hear KTOO on K210 AS 89.9. Also live online at www.ktoo.org. Come here tomorrow at 3 o'clock on a Juneau afternoon. Pam Moore will be your host. She'll talk with Mark Whitman and Bob Bangert about the second annual Liars and Fiddlers Concert. Judith Bendersky will be giving us how to get ready for Medicare. We'll also talk with John Hatton about the Kentucky Clodhoppers. At Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more tomorrow at 3 on a Juneau afternoon. With the forecast for tonight, mostly clear skies with increasing high clouds, later on low temperatures around 31 degrees. Forecast for Tuesday, cloudy skies with high temperatures around 57 degrees. Don't forget, live broadcast of the 38th Annual Alaska Folk Festival begins on KRNN tonight at 7 o'clock. Continue evening concerts at 7 o'clock every day this week, and afternoon concerts on Saturday and Sunday. Thank you for tuning in to Juneau Afternoon today, and have a pleasant evening and joining us at the Folk Festival.
Summer.
I don't know, Audrey.
I'm going to camp to learn how to tinker.
What's tinker? Never heard of it.
You know, build things, take things apart, stuff like that.
Sounds awesome. Where?
Here in Juneau and in Ketchikan, too. STEM AK is offering a bunch of different camps for kids of all ages.
Are they any good?
Yeah, I did their kitchen chemistry camp last year, and now I'm the family's master chef.
Cool. How do I sign up?
Check out all the STEM summer camps in Juneau and Ketchikan at stemak.org. Or call Bob at 523-2342.